I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, just in time for Halloween, I'll be speaking with Chris Alexander of Delirium Magazine about the joys of horror cinema. Chris was the former editor-in-chief at the horror magazine Fangoria before starting Delirium Magazine with Full Moon Studios' Charles Band. A lifelong fan of the genre, Chris is engaged with horror as a film critic, filmmaker, and as a musical composer. His musical forays include 2008's Music for Parasites, 2015's Music for Murder, 2017's Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, and 2018's They Drink Your Blood. Chris's films include Blood for Irina, Queen of Blood, Female Vampire, Blood Dynasty, and, most recently, Space Vampire. In this conversation, we cover a number of different areas related to the genre, including the subversive potentials of horror, Chris's defense of the 1970s blaxploitation cult classic Blackula, the cutting social commentaries of George A. Romero's Living Dead trilogy, the wild films of Texas Chainsaw Massacre director Tobe Hooper, the Euro horror of Jean Rollin and Jess Franco, an examination of the cinematic universe of David Cronenberg and the horrific themes that tie together his films, finding horror in unlikely places like the films of Orson Welles and Werner Herzog, Chris's own films and their highly experimental approach, and much, much more. And with that being said, turn down the lights. It's about to get spooky as I speak with Chris Alexander about horror cinema on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome to Parallax Views, Chris Alexander of Delirium Magazine.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
So I wanted to have you on because it's the Halloween season. You've done a lot of horror journalism, formerly working at Fangoria. You've even done some film scores and even a few horror movies. What got you into the weird world of horror?
I think it was in my blood, first of all, because my dad was into weird stuff. And, you know, I think it was a couple things, though, I remember explicitly. One was with my dad at a library in Toronto, which is where I live. I was 3 years old, and I discovered someone had misfiled in the children's record section a copy of Kiss's album Love Gun. And I remember seeing the Ken Kelly art at the front with the if you know that cover, it's a painting of the band, and they look like gods, except Gene Simmons has bat wings and fangs. And I didn't know what the hell I was looking at, and it really frightened me. And there were these kind of like vampire women swooning at their feet, and there was fog and this like dungeon kind of chamber they were in. So I was quite frightened. I used to have nightmares that Kiss was drifting through my ceiling vent when I was little. I didn't know what they were, really. So there was that finding that kind of visual really alarmed me. And then my uncle, who was who's still with us, he was slow. He is slow, but he's almost savant-like in that he was a genius with puzzles and collecting things, and he loved and still does monsters. And he had all the Aurora monster kits. He had movie posters. He had everything. And I was fascinated and terrified by his room. And then eventually I started hanging out with him, and we'd stay up all night and watch horror movies together. And so all these different things that were kind of combining, plus a love of comic books. And you know, I was free to explore these things. But I think Kiss was probably my first entry point into really seeing something that was so arcane and so bizarre and yet so fascinating. I couldn't figure out what it was, what planet it was coming from, and how I could kind of find out more about it. And then there's the tipping point, the full Monty gong show of horror, was when my grandmother took me to the Niagara Falls, the Canada side of the falls. And there's a haunted house there. It's still there, called the House of Frankenstein. And it was and still is one of the greatest wax museums I've ever been in. And I think it was probably a 4. And once you enter, you can't leave. So it was like entering the seventh circle of hell. There were these sound effects. There was monsters everywhere. It was a nightmare. But I couldn't leave. So I bury my face, then peek out through my fingers and see things. And then the big shocker was when it was over. I was screaming the whole way, but when it was over and I left, it exited out the gift shop. And I remember seeing all these snow globes and hearing this Muzak playing, and everyone was very calm. And I couldn't, there was the dichotomy. I couldn't make peace with the fact that only seconds before I was in hell. And yet somehow now it's like none of that even happened. So that kind of, not intellectual, although it sowed the seeds for kind of an intellectual attraction to why I was so, you know, attracted to these bizarre kinds of entertainments and what their effect was on me. And it was a detrimental, was it positive? I mean, I wasn't sure. So ever since those days, I have been on a pretty solid, straight road to becoming what I would become. And that was somebody who, you know, explores and experiments in all various medias, trying to figure out why we as a culture, as a species, gravitate towards these darker entertainments.
Yeah, and it is a really interesting question, because there's so much to, you know, the horror genre, even though I think in a lot of ways it gets unfairly sort of looked down upon as you know, lowbrow by certain critics. There's so much to it. There's the sort of catharsis that we get from watching horror films, and there's also that sort of fun aspect to it that you get from like the famous monsters of filmland,
sure,
side,
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, I'm a big carnival, circus, sideshow culture guy too. So, you know, that all kind of plays into that same ballpark where you're entering this kind of, you know, carnivalesque, phantasmagorical, you know, domain where, yeah, sure, I guess, you know, if you're part of the hoi polloi and the elite, you could look down on this kind of entertainment as low and seedy and sleazy and tapping into the most base, you know, Freudian id aspects of our minds. But and it does. But that's where all the fun stuff is. That's where the blueprint for what we are is. That's where it lies. To me, it's, you know, horror movies. And if you look at any culture, you know, the cultures that have horror movies, because, you know, I find that some cultures that eat, sleep, and breathe violence, for instance, are less interested in, you know, have kind of, you know, volatile political situations or social unrest. Not so interested in horror movies because they live it. They don't have to experience it by proxy. But if you look at all these various cultures through their darker films, it's kind of how you can study them at any point, given point in their history. I think horror movies have always been a fascinating portal into that that darker side of us that we keep trying to bury. And I think it comes down to, ultimately, I think I've made this conclusion, is that we're always trying to pretend, you know, our Western culture is always trying to pretend that we're not going to die. It's something that we pretend is not really ever going to happen. And so when it finally does happen, or it's upon us, It's almost just like, you know, I'm shocked there's gambling back. I mean, it just hits us and we're just like, we're not ready for it, because we've never really wrapped our heads around seriously to look at death without anything but fear. And so I think our fascination with burying death has kind of create, or not our fascination, but our societal or Judeo-Christian or whatever it is, to kind of deny death, to bury it, has somehow kind of created this monster that is the horror film, or the horror entertainment. It's kind of been perverted out of that. Sort of like when you deny sex, that creates the whole raincoat culture of guys hanging around in jerk-off boots and porn theaters. You know, I mean, that's pervert something that's so natural and organic, it's going to get weird. So I think that's what's happened with us. We've denied death and we've perverted it.
Well, the other interesting thing for me about all of this is, especially horror films, what has always drawn me to horror films is how subversive they can actually be. You mentioned being into the sort of sideshow and carnival culture. One of my favorite horror films is probably Todd Browning's Freaks, because it's
absolutely
such a politically subversive film where, you know, the freaks in the title, you can say that, oh, Todd Browning is referring to the actual, like, deformed freaks, quote unquote, in the movie. Or you can look at it as, no, he's talking about the moral freaks.
Yeah.
The two, what is it, the beautiful woman and the strong man who...
Yeah, Hercules and Cleopatra, yeah. Yeah, I know, absolutely. No, obviously Browning comes from the circus. That's where he came from. That was his... So when he made Dracula, they kind of, you know, he was being wooed by every studio. He could do whatever he wanted, and what he wanted to do was make the ultimate sideshow movie. And obviously the title was referring to his pals in the carnival. But you're right, the monsters of the movie... If it can even be considered, I mean, it's a horrific film when it becomes one, but it's such an odd film. I think it's genreless because it's not really anything. MGM tried to market it as a horror film, and that's how it blew up in their face. But it's its own thing. But yeah, if you're going to look at it that way, the only monsters in the movie are Hercules and Cleopatra, and they are as able bodied as you and I. So yeah, it's such a strange, amazing movie. I showed my kids. I have three little boys. 11, 9, and 7 as of this recording, and I showed them Freaks a few weeks ago, and they were just mesmerized. Absolutely adored the film as a tragedy, as a unique, one-of-a-kind experience.
Yeah, and it's there's a few other films that I feel are subversive in that same way. Another big one is like Clive Barker's Nightbreed, where, you know, that's another one where the monsters are actually the good guys. It's the humans that are the bad guys.
Well, you know, my favorite thing of all time that's not alive, my favorite entertainment is the Twilight Zone, and my favorite writer of all time is Rod Serling. I think he's the greatest moralist of our times. But so the Twilight Zone is my life. It has been since I was very, very little. That was another part of my salad days, was experiencing the Twilight Zone reruns with my dad late at night. So I've introduced that to my children as well. And, you know, that's what Serling was always trying to say. And he was always using aliens and monsters and to kind of hammer home the fact that, there's that great episode from season one, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, where they're convinced, I don't know if you know that episode, but they're Claude.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, they're convinced that, you know, the power goes off. So they're convinced that there's some sort of alien threat. And they end up cannibalizing each other, not literally, but murdering each other and going into a frenzy because they can't make sense of it. They're blaming each other. You know, it's got to be this guy. No, it's got to be this guy. Just fear completely consumes them, and they end up destroying themselves. And then it pans back, as you know, and the aliens are observing it. They've kind of just flipped. All they had to do was flip off the lights to see what we're really like underneath the skin. And we're the monsters. It's not them. It's not the aliens. It's us. And I think that's what Serling was always trying to hammer home in the best moments of that show.
Yeah, and it's sort of it brings us around to the way I discovered you, actually. It was an article you wrote about, I would say it was a pretty subversive horror film for its time, Blackula. And the article was, I believe it was called The Beauty of Blackula on ComingSoon.net.
Can you
tell me a little bit about Blackula and why you were so interested in that film?
I was funny. There's a British or Scottish podcast that just had me on a few weeks ago. The episode was called In Defense of Blackula. I was kind of uncomfortable with that because I didn't think Blackula can be analyzed and discussed. I don't think it really needs a defense because I think it's such a great movie. But no, I mean, Blackula was... You know, if you know the film, you know that it comes out of, it was a, you know, a marketing gimmick in a way, because it was coming out of the Hammer horror movies were kind of winding down. So the interest in Dracula was still there, but stuffy gothic movies were not. And blaxploitation pictures like Coffee and Foxy Brown, and those were De Rigueur and Sweet Sweet Back's Badass Song. These were very popular political movies. And so, you know, American International Pictures created Blackula as it was just supposed to be an exploitation picture. And really, that's the way the movie was written initially, too, until they hired, Shakespearean actor William Marshall to take over the role. And he basically said, fuck this, you know, and he didn't, I wouldn't say completely rewrote it, but he definitely riffed and had enough influence on the production that he changed it. And it became, if you've seen the film, it opens up with Blackula, which is kind of his gimmick name. His real name is Prince Mamawaldi. He's an African prince, a dignitary, very articulate and regal. And he and his wife are sitting down in Transylvania as guests in Count Dracula's castle. And of course, unbeknownst to them, Dracula's a vampire. They just think he's a European nobleman who has some control of the slave trade. And they're trying to convince him that the slave trade must end. And they believe they're on the same page. And of course, Dracula, when he gets wind of this, starts laughing, maniacally, and says, there's no way I'm going to stop the slave trade. It's great business. And you know what? You're pissing me off, and I'm going to kill your woman and put the bite on you and entomb you forever and curse you with the same kind of vampirism I have. So the entire way which was not in the original script, that Blackula, this black vampire, goes prancing around the streets of L.A., is that he was, he was royalty, and he was trying to stop slavery and got punished for it by the white man. So I mean, I think it's very, very interesting just right off the bat. But outside of that, it's just a really smooth, stylish, funny, but also very serious, but not heavy-handed in its politics. I think it's just always bubbling there under the surface. And when it's funny, I don't think we're ever laughing at Blackula. I think the humor is very sly. And it's also quite frightening. I mean, the movie, the joke is the title. That's the only funny part I find of Blackula that you can laugh at is the joke. The title is ludicrous. But the movie's not. And there's some moments in that film that to this day still, chill my blood. These pasty-faced black vampires running in slow motion through the corridors of a morgue, for instance. I mean, just these nightmarish scenes. And then it adds more to that, and it's almost a reverse minstrel kind of thing. These are black actors, but they've been painted white as soon as they become evil. It's quite interesting. So there's a lot to explore in that movie, and a lot of its subtext and intellect comes from that amazing William Marshall, who later on, I wouldn't say this generation, that's for sure, although it's on Netflix now again, Pee-wee's Playhouse. So maybe another generation is discovering it. But William Marshall was also the king of cartoons on that show. But anyway, so yeah, Blackula is a really, really, really great goddamn movie, which I don't think enough people give credit to it as a great horror film. They think it's just some kind of romp. But I think The Simpsons also kind of screwed that up, because there's a Simpsons episode. You know, there's a bunch of black horror movies in the 70s, like Blackenstein, which is a piece of shit.
Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, that's actually pretty good. I think Bernie Casey's in that one. That one's
same
actually
director
pretty good.
Too. William Crane,
yeah, that's right.
Who also
it
did Blackula.
You got it. Yeah, exactly. That one's pretty good. But there's that Simpsons episode where they're like, next, Blackula, followed by Blackenstein, then the Blunch Black of Bloater Blaine. It was a joke. So I think a lot of people know Blackula based on its title and haven't really explored it as a serious horror film.
Well, so I've introduced a lot of younger, people at my college and whatnot to blaxploitation films, and their initial reaction is like, is this like some type of like racist thing when they hear the term blaxploitation? But I don't think those films are ever meant to necessarily be racist, even if they're exploiting, sort of
you're right. I mean, they were, I mean, they're called blaxploitation movies, but again, they weren't set out. They didn't, Melvin Van Peebles didn't set out when he made Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song or Godfrey Cambridge with Watermelon Man or any of these movies where they said, we're making a blaxploitation movie. They were just making movies that had something to say about the black experience in America. And this was obviously a time of social upheaval, and, King had been assassinated. There was the Black Panthers were on front page news. I mean, there was Vietnam. There was this, bubbling cauldron in American politics, social culture, everything. And you know, black voices were in the forefront. So these movies kind of leaked out organically, and they were made by African Americans. They were made by black people. But so no, obviously in the early days, no. But I think as there's this wave, popular wave of cinema, as anything happens, and we can talk about horror movies being the exact same thing, and why critics sneer upon horror movies, isn't usually because they're horror movies. It's usually because what happens is one horror movie does something that shakes the foundation, then 52 other guys come along and try to copy that. And so they become, it's like photocopying a picture over and over and over and over. The formula repeats and the picture gets degraded as it goes. And I think that's what happened with blaxploitation movies too. So although not racist initially, listen, most of those movies were made by white guys, you know. I mean, one of my favorites of all time is you know, Coffee, and that was made by Jack Hill. You know, and Larry Cohen directed a bunch like Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem. So
Bone with Yaphet Kotto.
Yeah, so it started off as like this kind of, you know, important movies coming out of the culture, out of you know, authentic in some respects, and then it became product. So are they racist? I don't know. I mean, are Quentin Tarantino movies racist when he uses the N-word every other word? I don't think so. I think at all. I think those movies have something to say, like Django and The Hateful Eight especially. But certainly you can raise an eyebrow and kind of, you know, wonder about the authenticity of a person who has not walked a mile in the shoes of an African-American, you know, freely bandying about tropes and cliches and as tools in their, you know, arsenal to make an entertainment. Might be viewed as some askance today when you really look at some of those movies. But I mean, I think that, you know, it's just a different time, and it's, I don't think you can point a smoking gun at anybody. And I think they're their own thing.
Yeah. And I mean, Blackula is an interesting movie because I think there's a lot of, it has its sort of schlocky moments and its plot holes. But I mean, William Marshall is like you said, he was a classically trained Shakespearean actor. He sort of forced a lot of changes on the script. I think Blackula was originally just a guy named Andrew Brown. He's like, no, yeah. I want him to be dignified. And, you know, the whole references to the slave trade and the fact that Blackula isn't really like this evil guy. Like, he doesn't actually want to kill people. He just becomes, he's like the Hulk. When he gets angry, he'll attack. Even the girl he's smitten with in the movie, he won't change her by force.
No, he's a gentleman. It's a very romantic movie, as I think the best vampire movies are. And there weren't too many romantic vampire movies. You know, the Hammer movies were not romantic. The Dracula was always just he was a cipher. He just showed up and like killed a bunch of people. He was almost like they're almost like slasher movies in their mechanisms. I think it was Dark Shadows really kind of brought romance back to the vampire, but Blackula was certainly an early one. So it's a romantic film, but you're right. He's not, you know, he's just kind of, it's a fish out of water story. He's trying to figure out what the hell's going on, what world he's in, and make sense of it all while he's prancing around LA in this bloody cape. But there's that moment when I forget the actress's name, but the cab driver, the female cab driver, you know, almost hits him as he's trying to chase down Vanetta McGee. And, you know, she's berating him. She's ripping, tearing strips off him in the middle of the street. And he's kind of not even paying attention to her. He's like, you know, it's your fault she got away. And he's ignoring her. It's like he's taking it all, until she stops. And she's like, well, this guy's not reacting to my insults, so I got a hit below the belt. And she stops for a minute and she calls him boy. And as soon as she does that, he just turns around. It's like, that's the thing that got him. It wasn't, you know, the insults bounced right off him until she just called him boy. And it brought back that lip curling, sneering racism that actually wakes up the beast inside him. And then his sideburns get all shaggy and his eyes go bloodshot and his fangs
grow. It's
almost
like Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, it is. But it's those, he has the certain triggers that trigger the bloodlust or the feral nature of him. And I always found that scene in particular very interesting, because as soon as she says that, she knows she stepped in it. She went too far, you know, and she pays for it with her life.
Yeah, it's one of those films that there is that sort of, there's a lot of like subversive elements to it. Some of them may be accidental, like how the vampires sort of turn white, you know.
Yeah, no, but I like that. Like I said, it adds I don't think it's by intent that they said, well, look, isn't it great that when they turn evil, they turn white? Is it this? Were we saying something? I don't think they were, but it just has that kind of undercurrent. I think most of the best horror movies that we call political are kind of happened by accident. That goes for like Night of the Living Dead too. I mean, that's casting Dwayne Jones, a black American, as the lead wasn't something that Romero did because he thought he was making a statement. Dwayne Jones was just the best actor in Pittsburgh at the time. So it was the best guy they could get. It was not written as a black character. So it just kind of happened by accident that this became an important social movie. So there's a lot of that functioning in Blackula as well. It's kind of weird, but if you really want to make a case for it, there's something interesting about it, whether by intent or accidentally in the fabric of the film.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting on that note with Night of the Living Dead. I always find people referencing the ending where the sheriff's like, got another one when they shoot Dwayne Jones.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, you know, that was unintentional. It's just really resonant with people. Well, especially at a time like this.
George was a really good friend of mine, and he moved to Toronto then after he made Land of the Dead, and so I got to spend so much time with him, and it was just a remarkable. The last 10 years of his life, I got to be George's friend, which is just incredible. So we've had many, many conversations about that, and he said this since publicly, but what's really, really interesting is that. Yeah, I mean, he's not going to lie. Night of the Living Dead was made essentially as the movie they were just trying to make a horror movie so they could, you know, wind down their industrial company and maybe make features, be contenders. And he was basically ripping off Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. Not basically, he was wholesale. Driving this movie to its premiere in New York, he turned on the radio. And that's when King had been assassinated that very day, that very night. So it wasn't intentional, the ending scene that references, you know, lynchings. And it wasn't intentional putting a black actor in the role. But things were happening in America at the time that may have slowly but surely just been, you know, part of the fabric of where their thinking was at, that it just kind of happened because that was happening. And the way, again, people reacted to it, it became its own thing. Once you make a movie, you give it to the world, and however people interpret it, it takes on a brand new life. And things that people see things in it that you never necessarily saw, but weren't necessarily not intentional, you know, not there, you know. So that's probably one of those fascinating examples that I've ever seen in my life. Of a film really taking on its own, not only taking it on its own life after the movie was released to become an important social horror film, but after that, George, who is was a very politically minded man, was able to make movies consistently where he could say what he wanted to say about the world he lived in and use the genre. People wanted that from him, which is very, very rare. You know, that he actually had the luxury of being able to make political movies, but he could just cloak them in the tropes of the genre to get the money, to get the funding. But then he could say these things, and people were actually wanted to see intelligent horror movies because of that. And if that movie was not embraced as a political film, he probably just would have been making twaddly little genre films, if anything. So it's interesting. It's interesting, the legacy of that movie.
Well, yeah, and I always it's weird because when you get to his later films, you know, especially Dawn of the Dead, in a lot of the ways, Dawn of the Dead is almost comedic in some ways, just because of the plot of the zombies are all going to the mall because that's where they went when they were alive. You know, it's a very potent and humorous social commentary going on there. It seemed very intentional too.
Oh, well, it's not only intentional, it's actually in the script. I mean, Fran asks Peter, why do they come here? And he says this was an important place. Oh, no, it wasn't Peter. She asks her husband, I guess, Flyboy. And he says this is an important place to them. I mean, this is, you know, it's right in your face. The humor from that comes from the use. And, you know, if we're going to talk about George and the alchemy about his movie making, it wasn't just the scripts and the energy. And, you know, it was the fact that he doesn't get a lot of credit for this, but. In those early films, and especially Dawn, he didn't have, like, I mean, Dawn was originally cut with no composer. There's no music. There's no musical accompaniment. He used library scores, scratch scores. So he was kind of a DJ. He would pick up all these needle drop cues from, you know, the DeWolf library and all those early films, Martin and although Martin has a score by Rubinstein, but you know, still, and a lot of those key films, and you'd be throwing in this weird music running throughout. That's the energy of Dawn that it's my favorite film of all time, but that I always responded to was just the weird use of music. And there's that scene where the zombies are going up the down escalators and everything else, stumbling around completely befuddled. It's a horrific scene if different kind of music was played over, but he plays this 1960s polka song called The Gonk. Right, playing over it while these zombies are bumbling around, and it is hilarious. And George knew that. He really knew how to use existing musical cues to create some kind of unique voodoo alive in his movies. And you really feel it, because there's three different cuts of that movie. There's the Cannes cut, which is 2 hours and 40 minutes or something like that, the one he did for the premiere, that has no goblin music at all. It's just all his library score stuff. And it's, to me, it's the purest Dawn of the Dead, really. It's not my favorite, but it's the purest. And then when Dario Argento got his hands on it, he threw on all that goblin music, which is iconic, amazing music. But in the Italian cut that Argento released in Italy as Zombie, there's no library score music at all. It's completely gone. So it has no sense of humor whatsoever. There's no humor in that Italian cut. It's all blaring goblin heavy metal prog rock stuff, wall to wall. And it completely robs the movie of its soul, I find. You know, George was a really, really, really interesting filmmaker. And I don't think, even though people lauded him, you know, and the big dogs like Scorsese and all these guys would come out and say what an important filmmaker he is, and he was, but I don't think people gave him the credit for being this real kind of maverick when it came to just patching together his movies in such interesting ways. I really think that if you listen closely to George's movies, and that goes for Night of the Living Dead too, I think a lot of the horror from Night comes from the use of that scratch score music. There was no score for Night. It was, again, needle drop stuff. And fuck, man, the movie's so scary, and I think it's because it sounds scary, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's brilliantly done. That's the other thing. I think a lot of horror filmmakers get too much flack. You know, as we were saying, some critics don't think horror is high-minded enough, but, you know, even guys like Wes Craven or like a Tobe Hooper, there's a lot of interesting ideas in some of their films. You know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 has that whole critique of Reaganism and yuppies going on.
Oh, yeah.
And Craven's The People Under the Stairs.
Sure.
It's in your face.
It's in your face.
Comment
yeah.
on Reaganism.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I was never a great Wes Craven fan. I found him too. And it's not a criticism. Maybe I have to. I've always been feeling like I have to actually start marathoning Craven, because I the only movie of his I really, really, really responded to, although I do like People Under the Stairs, was Hills Have Eyes. I always thought that was his masterpiece. And I never liked Nightmare on Elm Street, believe it or not. But I always thought Hooper was one of the greats, because he was insane. I mean, I thought if you look at any Tobe Hooper movie, and I'm talking anything, even the late period stuff like Crocodile and shit, there's a certain kind of insane energy about those movies. And, you know, I saw Texas Chainsaw 2 before I saw Texas Chainsaw. So I was spoiled by it, because it's such a, speaking of carnivals and sideshow, it's such a sideshow of a movie. And it's just bubbling with bizarre arch characters and chainsaw duels. And it's, you know, it has its following now, but when it came out, it was not loved outside of Tom Savini's gore effects. People did not understand that this movie was just, this is the movie that he would have made back in 74 if he had the money. You know, when you go back and you look at Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's a black comedy too. I mean, it's quite funny, but it's because it cost about $1.99. It feels more dangerous than part two.
There was mob involvement in the first film too.
Yeah, it was like, wasn't it financed by the same guys that financed Deep Throat and shit? It was the same company, the Quadrant. I forget what they were called. I forget what the film company was called, but you're right. Yeah, it was the mob was behind both those pictures.
Right, they had to cover the fact that they were doing porno films.
Yeah,
and because all the porno films were mob involved, so they're like, oh, let's make a horror film and get the FBI off our tracks.
Well, you know, they always said, you know, that old expression was that, you know, the only difference between, which is incorrect, but the only difference between porn and horror is what spurts where and when. And sometimes Chainsaw Massacre feels like a porn without the porn, you know. it genuinely does. It's got that kind of flat acting and that weird kind of, you know, greasy, kind of sweaty feeling to it that a lot of the 70s adult films had. And it's just not, no one ever, the chainsaw's the dick. So, yeah.
Well, they make that explicit in the second one, but you know, it's interesting with Tobe Hooper. I've actually always found all his other films were more interesting to me than the original Chainsaw.
Me too.
Like Eaten Alive was really influential to me. It has that like weird Wizard of Oz sort of red color tint everywhere, and then Life Force, which I think has influenced you.
Yeah, my favorite. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think Eaten Alive is better than Texas Chainsaw Massacre. If you're gonna, it's not more influential or more important, but it's a better film. And it's what's great about it is like he was so coked out when he made that. And it was so many people fucking around with him that he was, you could feel that movie out of barely held together. It is completely and utterly maniacal, that film. It is, there's nothing else like Eaten Alive. It's just, it's on fucking fire. Like, it's just insane.
Neville Brand's Finest Hour. Oh my God. Crazed killer with the crocodile.
With the crocodile in his front porch. I mean, it's just, and then the whole maze underneath and William Finley, you know, just after he's barely survives Phantom of the Paradise, jumping into this thing, and Carolyn Jones with that awful makeup at the, and Robert Englund, my name's Buck, I come here to fuck. I mean, it opens with that. It's just fucking nuts. And then Life Force. Life Force is great because I feel it's just as nuts as Eaten Alive, except it's working. It's somehow, some way, this crazy Texan ended up hanging out with these crazy Israelis at Canon Films, and they had tons of money. And they gave him a shit ton of money to make the most insane fucking space opera. It's Life Force is so out of control, and yet it's so professionally made and so high caliber with its cast and its special effects, and it feels like a serious movie. But underneath it, it's cross-eyed. It's bananas. I fucking love that movie.
And the woman they got to play the female space vampire. Wow,
Matilda May, who I've reached out several times and. Tried to, she became a pop star in France. And I think she, for the Scream Factory Blu-ray, I believe they finally got her out of her hiding. Because I think that movie really damaged her. She was very young. And it was hard for her to do anything else in life because everyone just wanted to see her as, you know, the naked space girl, you know. But I think I saw Life Force. I was 12 when I saw Life Force with my mother, which was odd. On cable, and in many ways that kind of defined the kind of woman I like. You know, I was like, Matilda May was it. I mean, how can you get better than Matilda May? I don't think you can.
Another one that comes to mind is the Funhouse, which almost works as like a commentary on horror itself with this, you know, weird ending where she's being laughed at by the fat lady at the top of the carnival.
It's creepy.
It's weird because I feel like the directors that came out of that late 60s, 70s horror scene, they were making films that were not just your typical horror movie. They were doing so much more with it.
Well, I mean, listen, again, why critics – well, critics have always shit on horror movies. Because, you know, critics – I used to be a member of the Toronto Film Critics Society. And this is my chance very quickly to be critical of critics because I kind of – even though I do critique films and discuss them, I always feel like I'm not watching. I'm watching what pleases me, and I tend to talk about what pleases me as opposed to lambasting things that I find offensive. Because there's too many terrible movies out there that are not even just terrible, but film is so subjective they just don't speak to me. And critics are always getting together in a little gang. They literally do get together in little gangs, and they sit around and watch the movies together. And then they're always looking over each other's shoulders to see what the other person thinks is good, and they're always embarrassed. They just don't have the courage of their convictions to be bold in their what they actually like. Or they do that horrible thing where they call things guilty pleasures, or they call the movies so bad they're good. I mean, I just find it all very cowardly, and it's not why I love cinema, so I've kind of avoided all that stuff. But I digress. Yeah, I think a lot of times critics crap on horror movies, though, because with maybe some good reason, because, as I mentioned earlier, they're clones of each other. And one guy makes the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 50 other guys will make, you know, whatever other kind of spastic little gore fest came out that, you know, there was no gore in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But we can blame that movie certainly for the wave of more violent films. And Halloween, same thing, no gore in Halloween. And yet, you know, Friday the 13th was a direct response to that. And then there's a million, 10 times gorier direct responses to Friday the 13th. And each one gets worse and worse as they go and more slipshod. And they're made by Craven. People looking, not Wes Craven, but Craven people looking to make a quick buck off the success of the previous film. But the architects of the genre, the Tobe Hoopers, the Cravens, the Romeros, the Cronenbergs, all these guys were inventing, you know, they were inventing stuff, and they weren't out there trying to, you know, copy anyone else necessarily. I mean, they maybe had their influences and their inspirations, but they were blazing new new trails. And, you know, some of the, you know, we cite some of the big movies like The Exorcist. And I mean, and these guys weren't trying to make horror movies at all. They were just trying to make good movies, period, you know, first. And however they were marketed, they were marketed, but they were trying to make good films. I find today, and this is a tangent from what we're talking about, and I'll reel it back in really quick. What I find so kind of disparaging about this new generation of horror films, horror filmmakers, is that they seemingly, horror has become a culture in and of itself. So there's, it's almost like anytime you get a clique or anytime you get a bunch of people together, it becomes masturbatory. And I find they only watch horror films. It becomes how many horror films they can watch and how much they know about horror films. And they don't explore other movies. You know, George Romero's favorite movie of all time was Tales of Hoffman. It wasn't a horror movie. So, I mean, you know, it's you can feel that in a lot of contemporary films. They don't feel like they're coming from anywhere else. They feel like they're just regurgitating the greatest hits of shit that people rented back when they were kids. You know, it doesn't feel like there's any invention going on.
Well, I think everyone's into sort of their own film brand now. You know, I always complain to people about like indie is sort of a brand now with movies like Garden State, where it's like, let's make these depressive, like sort of comedies and indie films now. And I'm like, can't we like do something else with that? And I think that's what drew me to a lot of the those 70s and you know, 80s horror directors. Another aspect of this is interesting. I know you seem to have been influenced, at least in your filmmaking, by this sort of European end of things. A lot of people don't know about that, but there was like a whole culture of European art house filmmakers that were doing horror in the 70s as well.
Yeah, I mean, Jess Franco and Jean Roland, the two J's, being my all-time favorite. I think Jess Franco is my favorite filmmaker, and yet none of his movies are my favorite movies. And some of them I can't even watch, but it's his whole philosophy. He's a jazz musician, prolific filmmaker, and he lived to work and he worked to live. He studied with Orson Welles, so he understood cinema probably better than anyone else, any of his peers. And yet he was working so quickly and fast and all over the country with big budgets, small budgets, no budgets. And yet he didn't care. He was unstoppable because that was his job. He wanted to make movies, and he did it under different names. So if he liked the movie, he'd use his own name. If he didn't, he had a plethora of pseudonyms he could exploit. And sometimes he'd make straight porn films. Sometimes he'd make a movie and the producers would say, hey, we're going to sell this movie in various markets. We need porno inserts. And so he'd throw in some porn. And he didn't want to. So a lot of these guys were great filmmakers that got lost in this kind of ghetto, Roland being one of them. I think Roland's right up there with Jean Cocteau. But because he was working in a different world for different kinds of people looking for different kinds of audiences, he was always forced to shoehorn a lot of, in-your-face sex and into his movies that ghettoized them and removed them from people actually looking at them as serious films. Now people do, thankfully. But it took a lot of years, and he's dead now. It took a lot of years for people to really look at his movies seriously. But those movies always spoke to me, not because of their sex and cheap gore, but because of their poetry. I don't find a difference between Jean Roland and Jess Franco to like a Werner Herzog or something, because I get the same feeling. I'm looking for the same things. When I watch Vampiros Lesbos, I'm not looking for the two dames rolling all over each other. Well, maybe I am a little bit, but not really. I'm really responding to that movie because in the middle of that, Franco's camera will zoom off into the ocean to spy on a boat just slowly drifting across, you know, the horizon. I mean, that's, I find, the beauty of those movies. So anyways, I digress. A lot of those films I saw at like 2 a.m. when I was half awake, half asleep. And the feeling I had the next day was that I really did dream them. So the movies I've made so far, are very low budget, and I make them because they're low budget, I can do whatever I want. And I tried to create a style that was making a sort of film that felt like a dream. And it felt like I felt watching those films at like 2 or 3 a.m. You know, there's just a certain different otherworldliness about European cinema of that period, I think.
It's interesting with a filmmaker like Franco. What I like about Franco is he's such an extremely sincere filmmaker. Like his movies, if you were to watch them back to back, they start blending together at a certain point. He always repeats the story of like the surgeon who,
yeah,
who kills women to transplant their face.
Always. And there's always, and there's always, and even that, there's always a character named Orloff, because he, you know, always, yes, is. I mean, it's just the same. You're right. You're right.
And the obsession with literature too.
Yeah.
I mean, Franco was one of the people that did the only faithful, if not very good, adaptations of Dracula.
Yeah, yeah.
And Christopher Lee did that movie solely because he wanted to be in a Dracula movie that followed the book. And of course, he also did Venus and Furs,
yep,
and stuff about the sod. Very literary focused at times.
Well, those movies you speak about, too, were produced by a guy named Harry Allen Towers. And so that was one of the few times in Franco's career where he actually had a lot of money. And that was probably his... if not his creative peak, that was, you know, the richest movies with the best cast, the Kinskys and the Lees and all those guys were coming out of that period. And yeah, incredible films, really. And you're right. What I love about him, too, is that there's such an obsession. There's a level of obsession in Franco's movies. And what I love about it is that because, you know, especially I find his most interesting movies when he had no money, because he could kind of just make the movie he wanted to make. Oh, you want a vampire movie? Sure, no problem. And he'd go back and just do whatever the fuck he wanted to do. And usually that was repeating some kind of motif. It's almost like he kept trying to remake the same movie over and over and over until he got it right. You know, there's just a feeling about his films that they're, I always tell people like, oh, I've seen that movie. It sucks. I'm like, yeah, but you know what? It's not a movie you watch as a movie. It's a piece of a larger puzzle. And if you're really going to understand Jess Franco, you have to, you know, roll up your sleeves and be ready to do some work, because the only way you're going to get this guy is if you watch at least, you know, 20, 30 of these movies. And then you'll get a kind of a sense of the bigger picture of his movie. I find that incredibly interesting. So he is my favorite filmmaker, and also I think one of the most important filmmakers. But again, can't say that I'd recommend individually any of his films.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the same goes for like a director like Jean Rollin, who I always love the movie Fascination.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on there with sort of, there's like almost a class conflict storyline,
yeah,
hidden within that.
Yeah.
There's these directors are actually much more, they're so much more talented than anyone gives them credit for, and I sort of have seen that in a, I think that element exists in your films. There's sort of similar themes and sort of obsessions and an ethereal nature to it. Could you talk a little bit about your filmmaking? I think you started with Blood for Irina.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, yeah, I always have I like about the way I make films is that I really don't have to answer to anybody too much. So I don't really even understand the reasons why, except I gravitate towards female protagonists in films. Or at least it's the feminine nature. My movies aren't, you know, I've self-consciously made film. I think Scorsese said this once about Mario Bava. And I think it was after he made Shutter Island, because that's a very Bava-esque film. And he was talking about Bava and saying, you know, these are movies that you respond to. And when I saw them, you don't respond to them intellectually. They kind of bypass your brain and you experience them on a physical level. And you can't even really be sure as to why you're reacting to them. So for better or for worse, with my films, I've always avoided English. I've always avoided dialogue. I found, and I love dialogue, but I love all films, you know, not just horror films, but the kinds of film I wanted to make, even though I'm a writer by trade, were wordless, because I found them to be, again, much more abstract, much more interesting. And then you're watching this movie. For example, I screened my second film, The Queen of Blood, in Rome at this film festival, actually in Nettuno, which is just outside of Rome on a beach in Neptune. And it was projected onto the side of a castle, and there were bats flying around the screen, and it was unbelievable. With Luigi Cozzi was there, and all these Italians were just, it was this most surreal experience. But literally nobody, you know, there was people could speak English, but there wasn't an English speaking community. And they were watching this movie, and they didn't need any dialogue at all. And it's the best audience reaction I've ever had to any of my films, because they were experiencing simply on a physical level. They weren't looking for language. And I find sometimes looking for language in movies, horror films, hurts them. I mean, I went to watch Hellraiser 2 as a kid and thought it was the most visually, sonically immersive and stunning motion picture. And then someone opened their fucking mouth, and it was completely derailed. And I thought, oh my God, this movie would be so great if nobody spoke. And same thing with Suspiria, which is one of, you know, considered, and rightly so, one of the greatest sensorial horror movies ever made. It goes out for a smoke as soon as anyone opens their mouth with any of that dreadful exposition. When Udo Kier appears and tries to explain away what witches are, it's just cringe-inducing. And it would have been so much more successful if nobody spoke. So I kind of said, you know, in my films, I don't want dialogue. I want the movie to be function as kind of an outside body experience. I want it to be led by the feminine. I want it to be hypnotic and frustrating and boring. You know, I'm very self-consciously trying to make boring films. And I don't mean boring in the sense that you're just not engaged, but boring in the sense that it slows down to such a pace that every little moment that it comes up has a meaning to it. So you're just waiting. It's almost like foreplay, I find my films to be. So, I mean, that's changing. There's a few other movies I'm making on the horizon, which are still my movies and I still have creative control, but they're much bigger and bigger stakes now. So that will change and adjust as we go. But I've set out with those first four movies anyways, a kind of blueprint for how I want my movies to feel, you know, and I had that freedom to do that. I think when you're in the underground and the indie level, making any kind of art, it's your time to be experimental and find your voice. And don't try to make something commercial, because guess what? It's not going to be commercial. It's never going to play the multiplex on a Friday night. You know, no one's going to really see it except to your buddies and maybe some people at a festival. So do what you want to find your voice. You know, before there was Eraserhead, there was no Eraserhead. You know what I mean? Like, just it's your one chance to do something interesting. So I don't know if my movies are successful or not successful. Some people love them. Some people want them to be burned, which is fine. But I know 100% from stem to stern that they're mine, and they were exactly what I wanted to do at that period. So, and they're all driven by my music. I should add that. I usually write the music first and create the visuals after I've created the sound.
Were you influenced at all? I'm just curious because he's been a character that we've talked about a few times on the podcast, at least once before with another guest. Were you influenced at all by Curtis Harrington?
Well, Night Tide, right? So yeah, for sure. I mean, Night Tide is, Night Tide is, again, is a poetic film, but a flawed one. And again, I think when it stops for exposition and it tries to behave like a normal movie, it derails itself a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I my God, Night Tide is a huge influence on me, and it's a big part of what I do is trying to recapture that sense of dissonance and loneliness of that movie.
Well, there's also that sort of the fearsome feminine is an aspect that's in all of Curtis Harrington's
films. Yeah, and like The Killing Kind is another one that the John Savage, I think, is a masterpiece and not a lot of people talk about. And Queen of Blood, actually, Curtis did Queen of Blood, and that's where I still literally, not, you know, that was the title. My Queen of Blood is kind of a riff on Curtis Harrington's Queen of Blood in a way. It's not in space and it's not literally a space alien, but it's the same kind of, automaton kind of feminine figure that's a vampiric, you know. So for sure, absolutely, Curtis Harrington's an influence and an underrated filmmaker. Too, I think, you know.
Oh yeah, truly built brilliant. And you know, your Queen of Blood, I found it interesting that you described it as a vampire version of Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
Sure. Yeah. No, because Aguirre is like, you know, if you watch Herzog is my another one of my favorites. His Nosferatu, I think, is the greatest vampire film ever made, and it's almost wordless too. I mean, there's dialogue in it, but you don't remember the dialogue. It's the sense of, it's the use of the music and the natural locations and the obsession with nature and nature being a character in all his films. And I always found Aguirre really fascinating. I saw it for the first time again late at night by myself, and it's almost plotless. It's just Klaus Kinski slowly becoming unhinged as he floats down a raft down the Amazon trying to find the city of gold or wherever he is. And nothing really happens except a sense of it's an immersive film. It becomes an atmosphere and it's all consuming. And I tried to do that with Queen of Blood. It's a sequel to Blood for Irina in some respects. It's the same Irina character, but she's literally reborn as a different character. So I use her. I've done three Irina movies, although all my films are kind of like that, where you're taking the same character and you're just kind of rebirthing her in a different environment where she means something different. So in Irina, she's supposed to be nature, or in Irina, she's kind of a victim. And in Queen of Blood, she's reborn as this as nature itself. And she is the, she is this kind of spirit of nature out there trying to murder everything in her path. But she's not a villain because she's just doing what her she's designed to do, and that's continue. And all she wants to do is get her mitts on this pregnant woman so she can basically take the baby, because she has to continue. And the real villain in the film is the preacher, you know, is religion trying to make sense of nature, trying to put parameters around that which cannot be contained. And he's the real villain of the piece. So really, there are things I'm trying to say in that movie, but I'm not trying to throw them right in your face and pretend I'm an unimportant filmmaker saying great things about the world we live in. It's just something that I feel an idea that kind of drives the movie.
What's I recommend Queen of Blood too, because you were onto something earlier than most people, in that you filmed a good bit of it using your iPhone.
Yeah, the first one too, and that happened by default. So the first movie actually had it was called Blood Opera at first, and then the person I was dealing with money was a total shyster, and he fucked me over, and then didn't have any money, but I was ready to make this movie, and so we got a little bit of money from Severin Films. A little bit. The new imprint they were toying with called Autonomy Pictures. And we went out and made this movie very cheaply. But yeah, I mean, I was experimenting with my iPhone before Instagram and shit, like, you know, with the early phones. And also when I was a kid, I had a PXL 2000 camera, which was a Fisher-Price camera that recorded on a cassette tape. And they're very rare. And David Lynch made a film called Nadia that he used that film. And I think they go for quite a pretty penny. I still have mine. So I was always using whatever technology I had at my disposal to create imagery. And I was always liked using the PXL because it looked like nothing else. So even though you were operating on the same nickel and dime budget, your movie is going to look a little different. And I found the iPhone captured images in a very kind of, it wasn't so high def in the sense that it looked like every other independent movie out there. I thought there was, you know, if you watch Blood for Irene, it's kind of gray. So the iPhone thing was kind of an experiment while I was on set, while the DP at the time was shooting. And I just kind of was on the background, just taking some shots. And I just found when I looked at the footage that the iPhone stuff was much more interesting. And I could get in small little crevices and small places that the camera couldn't go. And I could be more fluid with it. And at one point I even dropped the phone in the water. I mean, there's a lot of that movie takes place in a coastal hotel. And it was so bad, the weather, the giant wave came up, took my phone away. And so there's some of that movie you see, it's like, it looks like an underwater filming, and it is, but it's not because I went underwater and filmed. My phone got sucked out to sea and came washing back, and I threw it in a bag of rice, and it was right as rain, but I got the footage. So I just thought, well, this is all really interesting shit. And plus I could dive in deeper into wounds, and if I overlight stuff on it, it does, the filter doesn't quite understand what it's looking at. It does something weird. And so I used it as an experimental tool, and same thing with Queen of Blood. You know, even though my DP during that film was ready to punch me in the skull because I kept diving in with the fucking phone, I found some of the most interesting footage we got was from that thing. So when I did Female Werewolf, the entire thing from beginning to end was shot with an iPhone, with two iPhones on tripods. And you're right, no one else was doing that. When I said I was doing that, people thought it was just, well, here's amateur night all the way. I'm like, no, this is an experiment to show you that stuff you can do with this stuff. And I think a lot of people do that now. I think I made an entire film on an iPhone recently. So I'm not saying I was trailblazing, but, you know, I've always been a fan of, it's not what you got, it's what you do with it. And I think sometimes when you're using technology that other people are not using, you can make your movie look and feel a little bit different, which I find interesting.
And, you know, there's just, if you have a moment, there's just two more things I wanted to, briefly delve into. And the first was, since you mentioned Herzog, I always tell people that I find horror in very weird places. I think there's a lot of horror in Herzog's work, but the one I always mention to people is Citizen Kane, the Orson Welles
movie. Yeah.
Because it begins in that sort of gothic, like, castle, and it ends there,
sure,
too. And it has this, like, the setting is almost like a Boris Karloff
movie, yeah,
at the beginning and the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is a sense of existential horror in Orson Welles, or even like reading Kafka. I think you can find horror in places that you wouldn't expect. And that's sort of what I find interesting about the genre.
Well, and that's my favorite, always have been my favorite kinds. I've never had, everyone's, tripping over their own toes to go see this Halloween movie. To be honest, I don't care. I've never cared about a guy in a mask. You know, there's that line in Fright Night with Peter Vincent, Roddy McDowall, talking about you know, all kids want to see is demented madmen in ski masks hacking up young virgins. I've never been interested in that kind of mechanical stalk and slash shit. I find it very dull, and I think a lot of people just attribute that stuff to what a horror movie is, and that's not what I think at all.
Well, those movies are nothing without Donald Pleasance.
Well, and I agree. And I'm like, everyone's excited about seeing Jamie Lee Curtis kick his ass, but she already did that in another movie, in H2O. And it's like, who gives a shit about that? Without the class of Donald Pleasance, Halloween is really just a guy in a Shatner mask following around a bunch of babysitters. It's a great score, but not a lot going on in it. I've never been a fan. So I digress. I was, to me, like, the greatest horror films are like Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves and Citizen Kane, for sure. I've always viewed that as a horror film. And, you know, the thing about...
I'm not the only one. Oh, my
no,
God.
No, my God. No, but I just watched The Stranger, the Wells film The Stranger a couple days ago, and marveled how I'm watching this thing, I felt more horror in this movie than anything else I'd seen. The sense of dread and inevitability and the psychosis and the complex psychological issues it addresses. To me, that's horror. But with Wells, too, remember, Wells came from, I mean, the thing that put him on the map was causing America to literally kill themselves in some parts with his War of the Worlds broadcast. So he was always about tapping into dread and horror and fantasy. But he came from the theater. So, you know, watching Citizen Kane is incredibly, everything looks like an exaggeration. Everything, to me, Kane is as much an exercise in surrealism as it is in anything else. The techniques, digging holes in the sets and doing all these bizarre things with cameras and experimenting and changing the rules of what was still a pretty early, in its infancy, technology filmmaking. But changing the rules but creating this kind of nightmare landscape. And you're right. Right from the beginning, as the camera zooms into a dilapidated Shangri-La that he lives in, it feels like you're in a James Whale movie, like the ultimate universal horror film. For sure, man. And then, I mean, my God. I mean, I eat, sleep, and breathe Citizen Kane. Sometimes I'm ashamed to admit that, because it's one of those movies that, you know, a 12-year-old kid will tell you Citizen Kane's the best movie ever made, because that's the one everyone shoves down everybody's throat. But it is, with very good reason, considered one of the greatest films. It just is, you know. But yeah, no, Wells always made horror movies. And you said Kafka, for sure. And he made I find The Stranger very Kafkaesque. And he did an adaptation of The Trial, right, with Anthony Perkins. So he was they're all those influences are, to me. And Herzog, I think every film he's ever made is a horror film. You know, there's so
man versus nature a lot.
Man
of
versus
times.
Nature,
yeah.
In the natural world with something unnatural inside it corrupting it. And when you watch any of the Kinski movies, it's always Kinski is the offender of nature, and usually nature has no fucking part of it and strikes back and ends up destroying them. And that goes for his Nosferatu as well. It's the same thing. Nature says, "You don't belong here," and aces him out. And I find those very, you know, you go up against nature, you're going to lose every fucking time. And I find that those movies operate on that kind of doomed level. And that goes with Herzog. This is another transgression from our conversation. But remember, he was born and raised in a small rural community. He didn't even see a telephone until he was like 17. So if any filmmaker alive understands the power and is humbled before nature, it's Herzog.
Well, it's even a director like David Cronenberg, who was recently interviewed in Full Moon Presents, Delirium magazine that you've worked with. People say Cronenberg is no longer a horror filmmaker. And I say, look at A History of Violence. Look at even Cosmopolis. Mm-hmm. There's a psychological horror working in those films.
I don't see a difference between Cosmopolis and Shivers, except Shivers has a very blatant prosthetic special effects. But it's all about, with Cronenberg's movies, it's the same thing. And you know, David, I'm lucky too in Toronto. I got Del Toro's here, Romero's here, David lives down the street. You know, you have these conversations with him, he kind of like, you know, whatever, you know, read into it whatever you want. But if you look into any of his movies, they're always about some kind of invading idea, or sometimes in the early films, an invasive species infiltrating a person or a society and changing it and evolving it for the better or for the worse, usually for the worse. But they're all the same. And Cosmopolis is the exact same thing. The Brood is the same. Videodromes, Shivers, Rabid, A Dangerous Method is exactly it's about ideas, philosophies invading a person and completely decimating their lives. All these movies, I think, are operating on the same level, with the body or the mind being invaded from some sort of outside influence and obsessing the person and corrupting them infinitely. I mean, I think they're all horror films. I don't think the guy has never made anything that I don't consider to be a horror picture.
Yeah, and it's, Cronenberg's films are interesting because I've seen a lot of the early horror films he's done get attacked, particularly Rabid. And I've always found the criticism of Rabid very interesting because, of course, it's, Marilyn Chambers, the porn star, she's the lead in it. And she's infected by this sort of zombie virus. And she seduces men and turns them into, these raving, rabid monsters. And people have always said that was a very sort of misogynistic movie. And I've always said I don't think that's what Cronenberg intended. I think Marilyn Chambers' character is completely she's not in control of what's infected her. That's what's so horrifying about it. So I think his films have a lot more going on than people
admit. Oh, my God, it's those early films. I mean, if you look at his really early films, the experimental stuff like Stereo and Crimes of the Future, those are experimental, cerebral films about technology and about, he's an intellectual. He studied to be an entomologist. He's an educated man. He came to film late. He's an intellectual. But the reason he makes those kinds of films, he went to Cinepix in Montreal, was making these French-Canadian porn films, and he wanted to make one because he wanted to work. And he took a train down there and said, look, I want to make one of your porns. And they looked at his experimental stuff and they said, well, you definitely have an erotic sensibility. We're just not sure what kind it is. So they said, listen, we want to make a horror movie. What can you do? And so he wrote Shivers as Blood Orgy of the Sex Parasites. And they wisely changed the title. But, he kind of fell into horror, but he was always operating on a kind of cerebral level, and he was using horror to kind of tell the stories he wanted to tell. Rabbit is probably his most on the table horror movie, because it's basically a infection vampire zombie film. But no, I think there's much more going on there. Shivers, Cronenberg always said that in Shivers, he thought the hero of the movie was the parasite. It had won and it deserved its victory. And it had turned its hosts into a more elemental creature, and that it rightfully won. And I think in Rabid, it's the same kind of idea. There's a certain kind of evolution going on here. She's Typhoid Mary. It's not a misogynistic film, and he didn't cast her because she was a porn star. According to him, he only thought of her as the Ivory Snow Girl. He did not know she was in Behind the Green Door until after. So I think there is a lot of subtext going on in Rabbit. It's an intellectual picture, I think, to some degree. Although, out of all the movies that he's made, I think it's probably the one that functions best as a straight-up genre film. I love Rabbit, though. And that's another one when we talk about use of scratch score. There's no score in Rabbit. It's drop needle.
Library music. Yeah.
Then a lot of it was used in like the Ralph Bakshi Spider-Man cartoon and Kingdom of the Spiders and in this Australian prison show, Women of Cell Block H. I forget what it was called. But so there's a lot of weird music in that movie that adds a sort of melancholy. It doesn't feel like it belongs in that movie, but it brings out a sense of sadness. And I think that's a very sad movie, Rabbit. I always feel great empathy for the Marilyn Chambers character.
Yeah, that's how I felt when I watched it too. I always felt a lot of empathy for her. I felt bad for her at the end. Before you go, if you could talk about your latest film, Space Vampire, which I assume that's a direct nod to Life Force and the Colin Wilson novel that Life Force was based on, Space Vampires.
Yeah, and I think all my movies too are based on Life Force to some degree. I've always loved the idea of, the vampire is always named Irina in my films, and that's because of Jess Franco's female vampire, Erotic Kill. She's Irina. And Lena Romay appeared as Irina in a few other films as well. It's almost like a karmic curse character that appears in various incarnations. So I've always liked, that was kind of a tribute to Lena Romay, because she had just died before we made Blood for Irina. Anyways, Yeah, so life force is definitely always a big thing because I like the motif of the walking vampire. I like the female just walking. And that's why I responded so well to films like Under the Skin and that all comes down to not female, but Man Who Fell to Earth, the early passages in that where he's just walking. I love that kind of like explorer, almost an innocence to this character that she's a vampire. She'll kill you, but she's almost innocent in her exploration. So
Life Force is such an interesting movie too, because at the end it turns into a zombie apocalypse.
I know, it's mental. It's everything. It's like Quatermass meets like whatever. It's Dracula meets Night of the Living Dead. It's insane. But anyway, so Space Vampire is interesting. It came from a couple things, and really Space Vampire should have been out many months ago. But what happened is my father died in the middle of all this year, which no need to be sad about. He died in my arms, and he said, "I love you," as his last words, and no one could ask for a better see you later than that. And we knew it was coming. But it derailed me to some degree, so I have to go back and put the – all I got to do is throw the credits on Space Vampire, and then Dave Dakota and I are ready to release it. I just have to get there. I've been so busy. But it was a pure experiment. My girlfriend at the time, we were watching some Crown international exploitation movies, and we stumbled on one called The Van with Danny DeVito, and it literally is just this young guy driving his van around, and he's just driving around looking to get laid, and nothing fucking happens in the movie, but we just thought it was fascinating. And then we watched more of these movies. Apparently there was a whole subgenre of films in the 70s called vansploitation. That's what they were called.
There's one that actually has Charles Bukowski in it, in a cameo. Yes. And I'm forgetting what the name of it is. It's called like Super Van,
I think.
Oh
my God. Okay, so you know. So there were so many of these movies, and most of them didn't have plots. They were just guys driving around L.A. looking to score, occasionally getting stoned. Anyways, I just love the whole idea of no plot. I've always been a huge fan of give me a good character, and I'll just watch them do things. I do not need the contrivances of plot to steer me through a tidy little 90-minute narrative. Just give me something weird that's more meditative.
Give me some Maya Darren and some Kenneth Anger is what I always tell people.
All that shit is, I love that stuff, and I love when it appears in film. I love when we see experimentation in mainstream cinema, which is very rare, but I love when we see it. Anyways. So this was a kind of a dead of winter. We poured my girlfriend into this cat suit, and I came up with this idea that she's just born out of nothing. She just appears, and she just explores and walks and moves and sleeps and wakes, and she changes. She goes from a castle to a bedroom to walks at night, and occasionally she may kill somebody or she may not. Is she ill? Is she just an ill woman having a death dream? Is she what? With nothing is explained, and the entire thing is a feature length mind trip. That's the entire movie. And this is by far, a lot of times people criticize my films for not having plot and for being too slow and being too arcane. And this is for people that hate my movies, this is an extended middle finger, because it is the most pornographically direct of my movies ever. It's just all trip stuff with this watching this girl in this cat suit move across city landscapes, country landscapes, coming out of trees, coming out of the snow, covered in blood. I mean, it's just whatever. I love it. I don't know who else is going to love it, but we'll see. It'll come out probably. We'll probably see this in about a month, I'd say. It'll finally rear its head. And then after that, we're still trying to get our movie Blue Eyes that Barbie Wilde from Hellraiser 2, speaking of, wrote with me off the ground. And the people that are financing that movie also financing another film that I'll be directing as well, which I can't talk about, but it's kind of a possession movie, but it's still very much one of my movies. It's a little bit bigger with a bigger cast and the most ambitious thing I've done. And then there's another project. It's a series that, again, an expansion of my universe, but it's a series for Netflix. We're trying to get off the ground as well. So there's a bunch of those things happening, waiting for, as you do, with the more money you require for your projects, the more waiting there is, which doesn't suit me very well because I hate waiting. But there's stuff happening for sure.
Well, I'm very excited about that. I guess the note to wrap this all up is you know, we were talking about, like, why are we interested in horror? You even appear in a documentary called Why Horror. Yeah. So, why horror? What do you think draws us?
I never liked that documentary because I didn't think we should ask that question. And I think we know. I think if you love this stuff, it's like you shouldn't have to explain it. I think it's just in you, a natural attraction to this. So that's like why horror movies. I mean, I don't think we have to really explain why, but I think why horror exists is because, again, it goes back to the fact that we're all going to die, and most of us are going to die violently. That's not true, most, but when I say violently, I just mean in the thralls of some kind of disease or nobody. Was it Oscar Wilde that said life is a moderately amusing play with a poorly written third act or second act? I don't know.
Right, yeah, right.
I mean, that's the bottom line. None of us gets out of this alive, and there's a genuine horror about that, and a sense of dread, and to fear the future, to fear what's behind the door, to fear what's coming next, and to fear what if there even is a next afterwards. That's just, we spend our entire lives trying to run away from the Reaper, and horror movies exist simply. Make us confront those issues, I think, in a very safe, benign way. And I think as long as we keep dying, that we'll still have these kinds of entertainments, because we're always trying to figure it all out, and we can't. And you know, religion is, I mean, the Bible is a great horror novel. Like, it's just we've been trying to figure out the answers to why we're here, to what's beyond, if there is a beyond, into what all this shit fucking means. And I think that's the horror movie's the most base, direct conduit towards those anxieties.
Yeah, and before the horror film, we had, you know, in France, the Grand
Guignol,
right? Sure,
yeah. And before that, I mean, keep going, before that, we had a caveman in a cave scrawling on a wall, drawing some kind of picture. You know, I mean, we've always had some sort of somebody trying to exploit and make sense of what the hell we're doing here. And what Grant Wignol's interesting too, because that goes back to Dawn of the Dead. I'll never forget, I was 11 years old and I rented Dawn of the Dead. I'd seen it in the video store for a while. The old Thorny in my cover was never that appealing. It was the triptych of Roger character moving up from the dead. So it looked really cheap. But I'd heard so much about Dawn and read about it in Fangoria, so, or at least saw it referenced. So we rented it, and we're watching this movie, and I was just mesmerized, and destroyed me. I was so terrified of this film, and it lasted for a year. I had night terrors. But when it got to the end and the zombies attacked the bikers and they ripped them to shreds and they pull out the intestines, I didn't know what they were doing. I didn't know what those ropes were coming out of his guts. I thought, what is this? I had no idea those things were even in us. No idea. So after watching that movie, I was walking around in such a heightened state of anxiety because I was suddenly acutely aware of just how fucking fragile we were, that we were literally these bags of blood and fluid and squishy mechanisms that could go at any minute. You know, it was just like, oh my God, what's holding me together? I mean, this is insane. I'm like held together by luck and duct tape or something. This is nuts. So, I mean, yeah, that's another reason why we get attracted to some of these movies too, is that, you know, some of the baser ones open us up to show us what's inside, you know, and freak us out that way. So anyways, yeah, we'll always have horror movies. I don't think that's ever going to end.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views, Chris Alexander. Is there anything you want to plug before we close?
I'd like to always plug my magazine, Delirium, which is, you mentioned it off the top there. I mean, I did start this magazine with my partner, Charles Band. Out of the Ashes.
Full Moon
yeah,
Pictures.
Full Moon,
the Puppet
yeah,
Master
and Empire.
Series.
I mean, my stuff's the Empire stuff, you know. But Ghoulies and Reanimator. But, you know.
Crawl Space with Klaus Kinski.
I freaking love Crawl Space. I love Tourist. I love the early Charlie stuff. But this was our little gonzo cult film magazine that I built out of the ashes when I left Fangoria. And I brought, you know, a lot of the Fangoria people with me, Mike Gingold, Bill Mahaly. So if you know, Fangoria's back in a new incarnation. But if you're a fan of some of that, like my version of Fango, and you miss it, then you should go check out Delirium. And you can subscribe by going to deliriummagazine.com. You never know what you're going to get. And yes, on the cover of this new issue that'll be out in a week is Canada's Baron of Blood himself, David Cronenberg. So yeah, give it a spin. I think you'll be impressed.
And also be sure to check out Chris's music. I've been enjoying it so
far. Oh, thank you. Yeah, chrisalexanderonline.com and some of my film essays and writing at alexanderonfilm.com.
Okay, well, thanks again, Chris Alexander, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks so much, man. It was a lot of fun.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Delirium Magazine's Chris Alexander, and consider checking out not only his writings, but his music, comes highly recommended by me, and his film work. And now, before closing out the show, you know, we've talked about the spooky, spooky stuff on this episode, and it's Halloween season. You know, that kind of horror is fun, but America seems to be experiencing some real horror right now. I just want to say that my heart goes out to victims of the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's a real tragedy, and I'm really not sure what to say. I'm at a loss for words in regards to this latest event. Something's got to give, folks. Something's got to change. So, again, my heart goes out to all those in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, affected by the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it. Just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.